GoDaddy.com. Use the code PODNAME139 for $7.49.com domain names, normally $9.95. GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1144, August 26, 2009.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you from some place called Rice Township, Pennsylvania. We're going to have a little bit different sort of a podcast. Haven't done one of these in a long time. Recording this on my Zoom H2. Spent the night last night at, I'm confusing the two. It's either Franklin or Anderson, Indiana. Wherever I unloaded last night, three times I referred to it as the wrong town. I think it's Anderson, but don't quote me. Anyway, it's on Interstate 69 northeast of Indianapolis. And that's where I dropped the trailer at last night. And then they sent load offer fairly quickly that picked up there at the same place today afternoon Eastern time, going to Lewiston, Maine. And so I got up around noon or so and checked back in with them. I was parked, they had a what they call a bullpen area, which is basically it's their own parking area for trucks. And they said I could park there, and so they did. One other time, I parked in there, and there was another truck in there, and after I was there for an hour or two, they ran both of us out of there. You know, you can't park here, even though I just delivered there. So, but anyway, the guard said, yes, you can park there, and so I did, and that's what, you know, but it turned out I was going to be picking up there as well. So, in any case, sometimes those big corporations can, you know, they can get a cob up their rear end or something. And, you know, and with different guards, you'll get, you know, it just depends on whether they want to enforce the rules or not, I guess. But, so in any case, the load was loaded, or it was already loaded whenever I checked back in with them. And so it turned out to be a pretty quick drop and hook, and then I got underway. And so I stopped for lunch, I think, at New Lisbon, Pennsylvania, or Indiana, which isn't too far from where I picked the load up at. And then after that, I pretty much drove until I stopped once and got something to eat, and then I drove all the way to, there was this pilot truck stop near Hazleton, Pennsylvania, or close to Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and filled the truck up with fuel, and at that point it was getting to be about midnight my time. And of course, that particular pilot truck stop is pretty tiny. It's been there for years, and the place completely fills up at night, so I didn't even try to find a place to park there. So I came on north on Interstate 81, and at first I stopped at the first exit of on Interstate 81 north of Interstate 80 here in Pennsylvania, and there's a truck stop there. It was just a little tiny rat hole of a place, and there was a couple of parking spots, but they were impossible to get a truck into. And so I decided I would try to come on up to the next exit, which I did, and there's no truck stop here. However, I I don't like to do this, but there's some kind of a, I guess this must be some sort of a state building. It's all fenced, you know, and it's, but it looks like it's some sort of a state building, probably that they use for salt purposes, whenever they salt the roads in the wintertime, which they have to do a lot in this part of the world. And so I was able to park alongside the, there's a nice wide area on this little road here. There's this nice wide paved area next to this state building that doesn't have any label on it, but it has to be a state building. It just has the look of it. So I parked here, and so far so good. Nobody's come along and tell me that I had to move. But I don't see any no parking signs. Now, Pennsylvania has put up a bunch of no parking signs on their entrance and exit ramps. There's a few drivers that are parking there anyway, but I would rather not do that because chances are they can probably give you a ticket if they wanted to. So I'm just going to take my chance and park here because basically I've used all my time up, used all my 11 hours up, and I can't really drive anymore. And so this probably looks as good as any. It's one of those places that can probably park with no problem, but I would rather not do it unless I'm kind of forced into it. And at the moment, I'm sort of forced into it. So it's a fairly nice night. It's clear sky. It's about, I think temperature-wise, it's about probably 60, probably just guessing, probably in the upper 60s. 66, 67 degrees. And as you can hear, there are a lot of nighttime insects that are making plenty of noise. And I think you could probably hear my reefer unit start up just a little bit ago. So, but as I say, it is a clear sky, and of course, can't really see a whole lot of stars because the state building right here is sort of lit up, and so it just, it's kind of lighting the sky up, so the only stars you can really see are the really, the more brighter ones. So, and plus there are probably I think there are a lot of people, there's a lot of houses in each one of these houses. It's more of a rural area or sort of a township area, so the houses aren't very densely packed together. But every house has its own little light, and so you do have that effect where it does tend to kind of light the sky up anyway. And so that kind of mitigates the number of stars that you can actually see. If you get out a desert part of California or someplace like that, and you stop out in the middle of nowhere, then you can really see a whole lot more stars. So, but that would be the case everywhere were it not for all of the lights that are on at night. But, that's just part of the price that we pay for civilization. You're better off having lights than not. So I decided I would just go ahead and record this with the Zoom H2 and get a little bit different sound than what I would normally be getting if I recorded it with Ubercaster, in the traditional, the way I normally do it. So, in any case, it's, as I say, it's a really nice night. I do wish I had a better place to park, but, at this point, I just have to kind of take what I can get, and chances are that a parking spot like this, chances are that someone else has done this before. As I do see a little bit of debris, and you can see where people have parked before because of the vehicles drip a little bit, and so you can see some stains on the pavement and what have you. So I think other people have in fact parked here before, when they didn't have any choice. And as I say, so far no one has come and told me that I can't do it. There are, now I'm not very close to any houses. I'm terrible at estimating distances. There is a house across the road, and then the house sits back off of the roadways, and then there's another house, another couple of houses actually. There's one in the that sits farther back that's next to that one, and then to the left of that there's another house that's a little bit closer to the road, but it's farther back away from the interstate. So, kind of going, I guess that would be going west. So hopefully my reefer unit starting and stopping won't be too much of a bother for these people. I guess if it is, they'll maybe complain, but probably not, since they're this close to the freeway. All night long they're going to be hearing vehicle noises. There's a lot of, you can hear the trucks and the traffic going by on the interstate, and that's, it's amazing how much noise vehicles make when they're going up and down the road. Just a car going by makes actually quite a bit of noise, and a truck going by makes somewhat more noise than a car does. But it's, I don't know, I was watching something the other, I guess it was maybe a television show, on Discovery Channel, and they were talking, there was a segment where they were talking about vehicle noise, and tires make up most of the noise, the tire noise, and then the air moving over the tire is what, that really makes a lot of the vehicle noise. It's kind of interesting. So they were in this show that I was watching, they were talking about, they had this, it was like a research thing where these people had this, it was a college somewhere where they had this thing set up where, it's kind of hard to describe, but they had tires mounted on it, and it was like a big concrete circle that was probably, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 feet high, and they had this kind of a pole in the center, and then they had this thing rigged up where these they could mount a couple of tires on this thing opposing each other so that the thing would spin. You could almost think like like you got your mom's mixer, you got a mixer to mix your cake with. Stick the thing, kind of perpendicular, and the thing would spin. Well, these tires were spinning around, kind of running on this, around the edge of this concrete circle as if it were pavement. And so they were testing different types of pavement and different tire configurations to find out, I think they were mainly concerned with pavement, but they were trying to figure out if they could, with different pavement, different types of pavement, if they could actually reduce the amount of noise that a road, a vehicle traveling over a road would produce. So basically, I think what they were in search of was pavement types that would actually be a little bit quieter, on average. And I think they said, we found something that's like 10 to 12% quieter. So that doesn't seem like much, but I guess it's something. But anyway, you can hear, where I live there in Northwest Arkansas, I'm about probably, I'm going to guess, 2 miles from the freeway. And on a quiet, you know, if it's a quiet night, I can usually stand outside. And a lot of times I can hear, if I listen carefully, I can hear some traffic noise from the freeway that's a couple of miles away. So these people right here are pretty close to it. They're pretty close to the road, so they're going to hear that all night long. And I guess, they get used to it, because I don't know, noises will bother some people a lot more than they bother others. Now, I guess it's because I'm used to sleeping in a truck. I can, and especially a truck that starts and stops all the time, I'm able to really sleep through some, the noises and the truck, starting up, and it rocks a little bit, and it rocks a little bit when it turns off, when the motor turns off. And a lot of these reefer units are very noisy from time to time, and so I'm able to just sleep right through that. And now if I'm at home, sometimes there can be, violent thunderstorms or whatever, and typically I'll sleep right through that as well. But, I don't know. Now, there have been times when I was younger where I would actually sleep through alarm clocks. I could have a clock radio cranked all the way up, and I would sleep right through it. Now that, as I've gotten older, and also as I've decided that I really didn't want to sleep through the alarm clock, but particularly as I've gotten older, when I set an alarm, usually, I'll wake up as soon as it goes off. There's a time or two if I'm really tired that I might sleep through a few minutes of it. But typically, as soon as whatever it is, if it's a clock radio or this one cell phone that I have that I use, I've had this one cell phone, it's about probably 4 years old, but it still works great as an alarm clock. It's an LG cell phone. It was a flip phone. It's like early, one of the early camera phones. I still use that thing as an alarm clock. It still works great. And so typically it just wakes me right up on the first ring. But normally I'll go ahead and, just in case, I'll go ahead and if I really want to, make sure that I wake up, I'll set it so that it goes off more than once, like every couple of minutes or whatever, for a while. And then, I build in a lot of redundancy just in case I happen to type in the number, enter the alarm wrong, as I've been known to do a time or two. If I enter the alarm wrong, or if I just put the wrong, like AM, PM, if I put that in incorrectly, I'll build in some different, a bunch of different numbers, so just in case. And then that way I do, whenever it does go off, I do wake up and I'm able to be sure and wake up on time. So, don't want to have any, if I really need to wake up, then I don't want to have any disasters where, I didn't hear the alarm clock, or the alarm clock didn't go off. So, but anyway, I guess, I don't know. I got an email, I'm on an Apple email list, and I got an email from the iTunes, from Apple. Basically, they send iTunes stuff, and then they send just different Apple stuff every so often. They don't really do it all the time, but just every, periodically, maybe once or twice a month or something. It just depends on what's coming out. But I did get an email from them saying that the next version of OS 10 is going to be in the stores, the so-called Snow Leopard. that's, you know, it's the next upgrade to the, you know, to what I, and I don't know what the number is. It's 10.5 point something, or it might be 10.6, I don't know. But in any case, it's going to be available for sale, I think they said Friday, which I don't even know what day of the week this is. I don't have a clue. But in any case, that's supposed to become available, and you know, the upgrade's like $30, so no doubt I will upgrade, but I'm not going to be one of these people that just rushes out and does it immediately. It's probably better to let the other, you know, let other people kind of be the guinea pig. You know, and I would rather not break something that's working okay. You know, it's kind of foolish to, especially if you're relying on a machine, you know, or machine or machines, it's just not a real good idea to you know, install an upgrade operating system unless you know what you're getting. And, you know, and of course you want to make a backup and what have you. So I'm not really going to rush out and do that. I'll just kind of wait, and you know, and of course I'm subscribed to a bunch of different tech podcasts and what have you, and so the scuttle will quickly come out as to what people's experiences were. And there's labile, you know, it always happens. There are always horror stories where something goes wrong. Some, you know, somebody will lose something, or they may have to, you know, roll back to the previous version because it, something really gets broken, or, you know, who knows. But, and that, you know, anytime you make changes to any software, I don't care what it is, who it's from, if it's Microsoft or it's Apple or it's even Linux for that matter, when you make changes, especially to the operating system, it's going to probably affect some things, and it's probably going to break some things. And so this Snow Leopard, they're talking about, I don't know, there's like a 64-bit mode and a 32-bit software and 64-bit software and so on and so forth. And then there may be some incompatibilities with older, you know, some of the older software, which I am still, you know, I am running probably some older software that was, you know, that's kind of running through the, you know, sort of, it was intended for the PowerPC version of OS X. And, you know, they have this, I don't know, they call it Rosetta or whatever, where the code will actually run, you know, it's kind of an emulation mode that it runs on the Intel based processors on the Intel OS X version. So I expect that some of that stuff might break. I don't know how many applications that I have that are running that way. It's probably one or two, maybe some that I use, some maybe I do, maybe I don't. But chances are that there are probably some applications that are going to have some updates done to them or released before the new version of OS X will work properly. So I would, you know, overall, as I say, I would rather just let the other people kind of find out what the troubles, what kind of troubles there are, and then allow the software vendors time to sort of respond to that with their own updates, you know, new versions or whatever. And then, you know, when I eventually move to it, whenever, you know, and it shouldn't be too long, but when I'm able to move to it, then I can kind of know what to expect. But as I say, in the meantime, since I am relying on the machine, you know, it's kind of a production machine, and in a very real sense, it's a production machine, so I would rather not take any big chances with it. So, you know, and the same thing is true with Windows. It's always, you know, of course, I've done that in the past. you know, number of different times where I would get the latest version of Windows and then it would end up breaking earlier software. Of course, you know, in a lot of cases, I really wasn't relying on that, you know, on that software that ended up getting broken. But a lot of times in the case of Windows, devices get broken. You can have a device that has a driver for, let's say it had a driver for Windows 98, and then, or Windows ME, and then you'd update, or Windows 2000, and then you'd, you know, when I updated XP, that ended up, you know, I've got devices that are still in the closet at home that never, you know, the vendors never did come out with an XP device driver, and so those devices were just basically made immediately obsolete unless you wanted to go back to the prior version of Windows, you know, and you know, so I'd just rather, at this point, you know, I've been there, done that more than once, and would rather not go through that anymore. So it just doesn't make much sense to really be on the so-called bleeding edge of software or hardware, because there are always, you know, there's always some problems that have to be resolved. You know, just some of the updates that Microsoft or Apple, particularly lately, I've just heard about Apple quite a bit. Some of the, just the regular updates that they push out will end up breaking different things, you know, causing problems for people. And so there's, you know, I'm even kind of reluctant to install those until they've had, you know, they've been around for a while and they've had a chance to sort of repair them. Now, you know, in the world of Windows, there's been a few times over the years where I've gotten updates, the automatic updates from Microsoft, and they've broken something. But particularly after XP came out, you know, it was pretty easy. The system restore feature in XP overall, unless it's been damaged by a virus, the restore feature in XP has been pretty reliable, and I think that's also true for Vista. So, you know, and there's been a time or two where I've had to use that. You know, and that's one of the things that I actually kind of miss, you know, kind of, if there's something that I would change about OS X, Apple OS X, it would be that they would add some sort of a system restore feature. Now, I know that you can, you know, you have Time Machine and so on and so forth, but it would be nice if there was some sort of a, you know, just a built-in system restore feature that you could just simply immediately go back to a prior date easily, you know, without going through a bunch of rigmarole. Now, of course, on the other hand, so far I really haven't had any major issues. There's been a time or two where, you know, like on that Mac Mini that I have at home, there's one time where Apple put out an update and it ended up kind of screwing something up for a while. The performance on certain programs wasn't quite what it was, and then after a time, Apple came out with another update and it fixed it. Now, of course, it's a PowerPC, and that there, I think that's going to be the last. I think actually Leopard would install on that, but it wouldn't make any sense. It's got the Tiger version, the PowerPC Tiger version, and it just wouldn't make any sense to try to put Leopard on that machine because it's only got 512 megabytes of RAM. You know, I could push it to 1 gigabyte, but Tiger, quite frankly, works great with 512 megabytes of RAM on a PowerPC. You know, it works fine. It's not the speediest machine in the world, but it works okay. It boots fairly quick and works great for browsing. And it actually, considering what the machine is, actually performs fairly well. And so there's really no point in trying to upgrade it, per se. because it works fine for what I, you know, normally what I use it for. It's just a machine that I have in, you know, I have it in my living room next to the kitchen. I've got it sitting there, and if I'm going to be home for a while, I might turn the machine on and just have it handy in case I want to browse or maybe listen to a file or something, you know, or watch a video or whatever. And so it works fine for that. You can even play DVDs on it. It works great to play back DVDs. Got it on a 19-inch widescreen LG LCD monitor. That's really quite a nice monitor, and it works, you know, it works great for what I use that particular machine for. Now, I think Windows 7 is going to be coming out at some point, you know, maybe in October, I think is, I don't remember what they said the final release date is. And chances are I might upgrade, you know, because I've got, now the netbook came with XP, this netbook that I have, and I'm probably not going to put Windows 7 on it. You know, unless I get some definite feedback from people that have done that. There's really no point in it. It works great with XP, and XP is going to have to be supported for some time to come. And so it, you know, by the time XP is no longer supported, the machine's going to be, you know, it's going to be completely useless by then anyway, so you know, unless I want to put Linux on it or something. So there's really, you know, again, though, it kind of depends on other people's experience, and if they think that Windows 7 works good on it, I might do that. But otherwise I just keep XP. XP is fine for that machine. But you know, there is that desktop machine, that HP desktop machine that I bought a number of months ago, that I have at home, and I may well end up putting Windows 7 on it. Although Vista works beautifully on it, there's really no point. Vista does work really well on that machine, and then of course I got the Vista. This Vista virtual machine on this, you know, that I run in the VMware Fusion on my MacBook Pro, and the Vista virtual machine works pretty well. It's a little sluggish, you know. Maybe, you know, it might be that I want, you know, to convert that into a Windows 7 virtual machine. You know, create a maybe buy the family, you know, because one of the things Microsoft is doing different this time, they're buying having this so-called family pack that you can get, like, rumor has it that you can get like three install your Windows 7 on up to three home computers, because most people have at least three computers or five computers. A lot of families will have five computers, so I don't know if this idea of upgrading three machines, I don't know if that's actually came from Microsoft or if that's just a rumor or whatever, but in any case, depending on what the price is, I might do that. And I don't know, but again, as long as the stuff is working, there's really no point in messing with it. You know, if something's working, you don't really want to break it with an upgrade, with a software upgrade, particularly if there's software involved. If something works, then upgrades are actually kind of dangerous. And you don't really, the temptation is, oh, this is going to be better. You know, this is going to be, let's get the latest and greatest. This is going to be better somehow, and it's, you know, maybe in some ways it might be, but at this point, the software has matured to the point where it's probably going to be worse. you know, it's like Microsoft trying to improve Microsoft Office. You know, quite frankly, Microsoft Office 97 is great. You know, and then they came out with Office XP, and they've got this what is it? Office 2007, I think, was it maybe, or 2008? 2007. They tried to change the interface, and I didn't ever upgrade to that. I'm just kind of happy with I've got a copy of Office 97, and then at some point I ended up with a copy of Office XP, and quite frankly, either one of those works pretty well. It really doesn't, you know, like if I have to reinstall on a machine, it really doesn't matter which one I grab because they're basically the same. You know, they try to add new bells and whistles, and then all they can do is just start moving menu items around. One of the most maddening things that they ever, that Microsoft ever came up with, they had this idea that they would, and I think it came about in Office 97, they had this maddening idea that they would try to hide menu items by default. They'd hide menu items like in Microsoft Word or Excel. They'd hide menu items that the program was trying to guess, sort of trying to guess what you wanted to see or what you might use. And what it ended up being a really maddening thing because, you know, you got all these features and you kind of know that, hey, you know, this feature should be in this menu. And by default, they were trying to hide it from you. And so anytime I have to reinstall either Office 97 or Office XP, that's the very first thing I do is turn that feature off. As I say, they had that enabled by default, and it's really maddening, you know. So, but they come out with new versions sometimes, and it's just, you know, they're to the point where, you know, maybe they can make things a little bit more usable, but, you know, once people get used to certain ways things work, then if you kind of change it, it's really sort of maddening. You know, it's kind of like, just imagine that, you know, you buy a new vehicle and they decide, the manufacturer decides, well, we're not going to, you know, use the standards that have evolved over the years as far as steering wheel and brakes and accelerator and gear shifts and what have you. We're going to redesign this. This is, even though this works, we think that we can make it more usable. And, you know, and then they come up, you know, and to a certain extent, the car manufacturers have actually done that with certain features. Certainly not with things like steering wheel or accelerator or brake, but they certainly have done it with things like light switches and windshield wiper controls, or, you know, or like the little, you know, where they put the gas cap, you know, or where they put the little release for the gas cap or the release for the trunk or whatever. They have kind of moved those around. And of course, even if you go back, you know, like into the early 60s, Chrysler Corporation, you know, played around, you know, they had this thing called a push-button transmission. And so instead of having the familiar column thing where you have park and reverse and neutral and drive and what have you, they came up with this idea, well, we'll just have these push buttons, you know, where you'll have drive and so on and so forth, but you just put it in neutral and then you have to apply the parking brake because there is no park. And so they tried that for a few years. Chrysler did. I actually had one. The very first car that I had was a 1962 Chrysler. It was like this four-door behemoth. Thing was huge. But it had the push-button automatic transmission. And, it, you know, it was kind of You know, but Chrysler was the only one that ever did that, and they dropped that idea. After a few years, they decided that that was, you know, it was really kind of silly. You know, another thing that Chrysler did that was kind of weird, they did this back in the, probably back either in the 50s or sometime in the early 60s, they decided that starter motors were too noisy. And so they came out with this different starter motor that was supposedly quieter. Well, it wasn't quieter, but it had its own distinctive sound. And I don't know, you know, I haven't kept up with it in recent years, but, you know, even way into the 80s and maybe even into the 90s, Chrysler's, you could always tell a Chrysler vehicle when it's, you know, the sound of the starter motor was distinctly different than what you'd have with a GM product or a Ford product or other manufacturers. Chrysler's starter motors had their own sort of distinctive sound, and it wasn't any quieter, but it was just Chrysler decided that that was how they were going to do it. So you know, car manufacturers do try to, you know, change things around a little bit, you know, and they, of course, they suffer from the same problem. You know, they got to give people a reason to buy the upgrade. You know, you make them think they're getting something better, you know, and it's not necessarily any better. You know, sometimes manufacturers will take, you know, software manufacturers have done this. They take features away. And car manufacturers, I think, have done that as well. You know, sometimes they'll decide, oh, we're just going to take this away. You don't need it, you know, and that can be a little ridiculous too. So I don't know. When it comes to software, chances are you're probably better off these days, since everything's kind of mature, or it's more mature. Certainly not perfect, but at least, you know, as it's more mature, the software market's more mature, you're probably better off just trying to hang on to what you have. And now, of course, one way you can do that in the world of Windows, if you've got an older program that won't run on a newer version of Windows, say you've got a program that won't run on XP, let's say it won't run on, it could be XP, but let's say that it won't run on Vista, or it won't run on, you know, I don't know if it would run on Windows 7 or not, but let's say you have a program that would work in XP, but it wouldn't work in Vista. Well, what you can do is get a virtual machine and just make an XP virtual machine, or even a Windows 98 virtual machine, or you could even make a Windows 95 virtual machine. And if you really wanted to get hardcore and you had a copy of it, you could probably make a Windows 3.1 virtual machine. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but you know, probably the most useful would be like a Windows XP virtual machine, you know, because that's one of the reasons why I keep a Windows XP virtual machine handy, you know, and I do run it, am able to run it on VMware Fusion. It's because I'm able to hang on to some software. I've got this one piece of software that will not run on Vista, but it'll work just fine in Windows XP. And so I have this XP virtual machine that I have. And then I have, most of the time, I'm using the Windows Vista virtual machine on OS X. But it's just really handy to be able to run that program when I need to, on occasion, you know, maybe, you know, once a month, or maybe sometimes twice a month, end up having to run this one particular program, and it's right there in Windows XP, and it works fantastically well. And so that is one way of hanging on to an older piece of software, or even hardware, because quite frankly, you know, I could probably dig around in my closet and, provided I could find those old devices and the old device drivers, which they should still be in there somewhere, if I could kind of find that, I could probably resurrect some stuff that would work under Windows 98, but that wouldn't work on XP or anything newer. And, you know, if I really wanted to do that, I could, and using a virtual machine. So virtual machines are a great way of, you know, virtual machine technology is a great way of being able to hang on to older software. And of course, that's wonderful for businesses if they take advantage of it, because oftentimes businesses will have very expensive custom pieces of software that they bought for their business, you know, different types of database software or whatever, or custom software that they've, or high-priced stuff that they bought for their business. It's this really specialized piece of software, and they don't really want to have to reinvest in it, you know, because sometimes that stuff can be just outrageously expensive because there's only a few copies that are sold, or maybe they paid a developer to develop a specific piece of software for them, and the developer charged them big bucks to do it. Well, they can actually use virtual machine technology to hang on to that if they wish. And so that's, you know, that's one of the, you know, amazing things that has been developed in the past few years, and that has kind of moved into the mainstream, where you're able to kind of set up like an XP virtual machine, or even a Linux virtual machine, or a Vista virtual machine, Windows 98 virtual machine, and just kind of hang on to that. Now, I wish they would turn it around the other way and you could come up with an OS 10 virtual machine, but that would be kind of neat. So far, I don't know that anyone has actually done that, but that would be kind of neat if they did. it would be very interesting, but I'm sure Apple would hoot and holler if anyone did come up with something like that. So, anyway, I think I'm going to cut this off. Don't know how long. I don't have a clue how long I've been talking. So far, nobody's complained. No police have come or anything to tell me that I can't park here. So chances are I should be able to park here all night without being bothered. I guess I'll find out sooner or later, because I'm going to be parked here at least until probably noon, because of the, you know, when I stopped. So I'm going to be parked here for a while anyway, because I have to, you know, be here at least probably 10 hours. So we'll see what happens. As I say, there's no, I don't see any no parking signs anywhere, you know. So, and I'm off the road, and I'm on this, it's kind of a paved area next to this barbed wire fence that this state, whatever the state building is, kind of fenced in with. And then there's this kind of a guardrail right here that I'm kind of parked next to, and so I'm off the road, I think, well enough, so I don't think that anybody's going to, I shouldn't have any problem. I don't think anyone's going to complain, unless, you know, somebody decides that I just can't park here, but I don't see that that's going to happen. So anyhow, hope everyone is having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.